Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bruce Gagnon, coordinator with the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, who discusses the latest Pentagon test of the National Missile Defense System and growing concern that the program may spark a nuclear arms race. Wayne Besson, with the Human Rights Campaign, who examines the aborted deal between the Bush White House and Salvation Army, which would have shielded religious charities that discriminate against gays and lesbians. And Reverend Lucius Walker of Pastors for Peace, who talks about the seizure by U.S. Customs agents of a Cuban-made rat poison called Biorat, which the humanitarian aid group was attempting to bring back from Cuba across the Texas border. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A powerful new divestment campaign is gaining ground to break the link between Sudan's repressive regime and major oil companies. In recent years, the government of Khartoum has prospered by offering drilling rights to oil companies that trade stock on Wall Street. The oil money has helped fund Sudan's brutal war in the southern part of the country that has resulted both in the looting of villages and a thriving slave trade. To put economic pressure on the oil companies working in Sudan, such as Talisman Energy and the China National Petroleum Company, activists have appealed to mutual fund managers to sell all their shares of the offending companies. At one point, Fidelity, the largest mutual fund company, sold all its shares of Talisman, but later reversed course and bought back $191 million in stock. Church groups and other activists had more success when PetroChina, with the help of Goldman Sachs, tried to raise $10 billion in an initial public offering, or IPO. Human rights groups and the AFL-CIO urged top pension funds to boycott the IPO. As a result, PetroChina was only able to raise $2.9 billion, mostly from BP Amoco. In June, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that prohibits oil companies that operate in Sudan from trading stock on the New York Stock Exchange or on NASDAQ. Divestment activists are upbeat. Eric Reeves, a professor at Smith College and campaign coordinator, stated, "The end goal is to make participation in Sudan so painful that Khartoum will have to get the message." The news magazine In These Times reports that the Pentagon is America's leading toxic polluter. Each year, the U.S. military spews out over 750,000 tons of hazardous material and faces little in the way of environmental enforcement. Congress has exacerbated the military toxic problem by exempting the Pentagon from the federal Superfund program that targets the worst toxic waste sites. A recent study by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency found that it would cost over $350 billion to clean up the military toxic hotspots, more than five times the Superfund cleanup liability faced by private industry. But now the Bush administration is planning to cut the cleanup budget by 7.5%. The White House also wants to impose new efficiency measures at the Pentagon, which environmentalists contend is a code word for sidestepping federal environmental regulations. The Pentagon is now preparing to sell off old bomb sites and training grounds that are full of toxic bomb fragments, unexploded munitions, and buried toxic waste. At the moment, the Pentagon shows little interest in cleaning up these facilities before they are sold off. The U.S. Forest Service recently closed off some public lands it had purchased from the U.S. Army. In 1999, a Colorado hiker came across an unexploded bomb near an abandoned World War II training base. Clearly, the Pentagon's vast hazardous areas need to be cleaned up. In recent months, life has become dangerous for dissenting American Jews. In May, a right-wing pro-Israel website, Masada 2000, targeted Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, and five other peace activists for being the most dangerous Jewish enemies of the Jewish people. In Lerner's case, the website provided directions to his house. Lerner, who has called for an end to Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, has received several death threats and over 60 hate emails, according to the magazine In These Times. The threats on the Masada 2000 website are similar to those issued by anti-abortion extremists targeting abortion doctors. One site, the Nuremberg Files, crossed off the names of abortion doctors after they were murdered. The pro-Israel site tells its supporters not to harm Lerner, but declares, "God will deal with him soon enough." After Lerner received the death threats, the Anti-Defamation League eventually contacted the FBI, which opened an investigation. But Lerner is still outraged that the ADL did not initially take his case seriously. He states, "The ADL simply needed to follow its standard procedure and put out a public statement saying that such threats are inappropriate." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
On July 15th, the Pentagon announced a successful test of their anti-missile system over the Pacific Ocean, an important element in the development of a U.S. national missile defense program. This was only the second success of four such tests, where a mock intercontinental ballistic missile was destroyed by an interceptor rocket launched thousands of miles away. Although the White House and Pentagon played down the successful test, it is widely expected that this will assist the Bush administration in winning congressional funding for accelerated testing of various missile defense technologies. But many arms control experts believe the aggressive drive to test and eventually deploy a missile defense shield will, in a matter of months, abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed by the U.S. and Soviet Union in 1972. Russia, China, and many U.S. allies have condemned the Bush plan to scrap the ABM treaty, fearing that the policy will spark a new global nuclear arms race. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Gagnon, coordinator with the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, who discusses the latest Pentagon test and growing opposition to the revival of the Reagan-era Star Wars missile defense program.
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that in April of 1999, Congress, both in the House and Senate, voted in favor of the National Missile Defense Act, as it was called. In the Senate, the vote was 97-3 in favor, and in the House, the vote was 345-71. And this legislation called for the development of and deployment of this National Missile Defense System as soon as technologically feasible. And so this testing program going on now, the one just the other day, cost $100 million for that one test. There's a whole series of them to go. And certainly it is true that I think the success of that test is going to accelerate the research and development dollars that both the Democrats and the Republicans are going to pour into this ballistic missile defense organization. Bush, in the year 2002 budget, is requesting a 40-some percent increase over what they had last year. He's asking for up to $8.3 billion, so a significant test, almost a doubling of what they had last year. And so I think now with that test, it's very likely that he's going to get pretty much most of that money. But I think the most important thing is not to get too carried away with success or failures of these tests. Instead, I think we should be asking a real fundamental question, is should we even be doing this at all? Not whether or not it's going to work or not, but what if it does work? And should we be spending the national treasury even if it wouldn't work? And, you know, there's a whole lot of needs in this country that are going unmet, boarded up homes in the cities and education funding and health care, job training, all kinds of needs. And I think these are the real questions. Do we want to move an arms race into space? Do we want to carry this crazy, crazy bad seed of war and greed and environmental degradation up into the heavens now, start a whole new arms race? And I think we've really got to focus on those questions the most.
There are Democrats in the House and Senate who oppose some aspects of the Bush policy on national missile defense around the margins. But you have written in the past that you have some grave questions about the Democrats' ultimate purpose and ultimate objective in the opposition that they have thrown up to what Bush has proposed.
Yeah, I think this is extremely important, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but pretty much the Democrats are playing a game, a shell game on this whole thing. There are two different parts of ballistic missile defense. One is national missile defense, the idea of protecting the continental United States from attack, and that's what this test was, a national missile defense test. But there's a whole other program called Theater Missile Defense. The idea of TMD is to forward deploy these systems in the Middle East and in Asia. In fact, we're now talking about surrounding China with deployments in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, and on ships throughout the region. This will provoke China, who today only has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the United States, to build more. And what we're finding in the Democratic Party is two things. Number one is the Democratic Party, almost in lockstep, is saying, yes, we support research and development on all of this stuff. And so that is really pushing the major increases in the budget for this ballistic missile defense stuff. And then secondly, we find some Democrats, in fact, quite a few Democrats, saying, we oppose national missile defense, but we're strongly in favor of theater missile defense, which will essentially give them the same capability in the end. The Pentagon says that. The politicians are saying that. And so the Democrats are finding a way to make it look like they're opposing national missile defense, but in fact still supporting research and development, and then ultimately supporting deployment of significant systems.
What is Russia and China's reaction to all this, given the Bush administration's announcement recently of an aggressive schedule of tests on this national missile defense program that will, within a matter of months, violate the ABM treaty by some reckoning?
Well, Russia and China have very recently signed a kind of mutual pact, mutual assistance pact, saying that if the United States goes forward with this, we're going to help each other respond, because they both feel that what the United States is trying to develop is the shield. You know, we have the sword today. We have offensive systems. And now if you put in place this so-called defensive system, you then have the complete sword and shield, which allows you to attack other countries and for them not to be able to respond. And so Russia and China both saying, we will work together, we'll build more nuclear weapons in order to overwhelm any system we put in place. It's like the Maginot Line that the French built before World War II, and then the Germans, when they wanted to invade France, they just went around it. And on October 13th, we're going to have an international day of protest to stop the militarization of space, and we've now heard from groups in 16 countries at over 70 locations where we're going to hold protests. Our feeling is we just got to keep building the resistance around the globe in hopes that we can stop this.
That was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator with the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Contact the network by calling area code 352-337-9274 or visit their website at www.spaceforpeace.org. In an effort to win support for their faith-based initiative in Congress, the Washington Post reported on July 10th that the Bush administration negotiated a secret deal with the Salvation Army that would have provided protection to federally funded religious charities that discriminate against gays and lesbians in exchange for the Army's public support for the controversial legislation. Once the deal was exposed, however, both the White House and Salvation Army abandoned the arrangement. The embarrassing revelation highlighted the objections many have to the Bush faith-based initiative. Advocates for retaining the constitutionally mandated firewall between church and state fear that if signed into law, the faith-based initiative could institute taxpayer-funded discrimination in employment and services run by religious charities. Some in the religious community also oppose the legislation because of the government regulations that would be imposed on their charitable operations. A vote on the Community Solutions Act, number H.R. 7, that embodies the faith-based initiative, was scheduled to take place in the House of Representatives as early as July 18th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wayne Besson with the Human Rights Campaign, who examines the aborted White House Salvation Army deal and explains why a growing number of citizens oppose the Bush faith-based initiative.
This faith-based initiative has been stalled for the most part. And Bush desperately wants to get this through, especially after the campaign finance problems. We just saw the big blow-up with the whole McCain thing and Jeffords switching sides. He really needs a victory here, and he's been pushing it hard. And the Salvation Army would be a big part of that victory, lobbying on behalf of his faith-based initiative. But the Salvation Army wanted something in return. They wanted to be able to skirt state and local anti-discrimination ordinances and laws. So they apparently cut a deal with the Bush White House, saying that in return for their support for the faith-based initiative, they would ask the Bush administration to pass a regulation saying they could ignore, and other groups like them could ignore these laws that protect gays and lesbians from employment discrimination. And it backfired. In a very big way. I hurt the Bush administration. I hurt the chances of this getting passed. And it also hurt the Salvation Army, which was known as a moderate force of good in this country. And now, it's sort of like the Boy Scouts were once known, and now there's sort of a cloud hanging over their activities, which is a shame. It's just a good organization and it helped a lot of people.
What is the federal policy on discrimination and hiring practices and such within religious organizations now, as the law stands at this moment?
There's 12 states right now that say you can't fire on the basis of sexual orientation. We're also put forth at the federal level, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. It hasn't passed yet, but we're hoping it will at some point, that bans discrimination, again, on sexual orientation. And you also have the Civil Rights Act of 64. In all cases, there's religious exemptions as far as people can hire the clergy they want. Nobody's asking anyone to, have to be forced to hire someone they don't want to run the church. But when federal funds are involved, this is a whole new equation here. When federal funds are involved, should we still be giving them to organizations that discriminate on any level? And I think the answer is no. I mean, that's what makes them federal funds. As long as they're a private organization, a private church or synagogue or mosque or what have you, they're free to discriminate. But as soon as you start throwing public money into the mix, and that's why this faith-based initiative, for all the good things it does, might be a bad idea in the end. It's really has the potential to chip away at that wall between separation and church and state, and again, have people subsidizing their own exclusion and paying for services for other people that they can't access themselves. I would be very worried about that, no matter who we are.
Would the Bush administration, despite this scandal here with the Salvation Army, would the Bush administration be able to exert their influence to exempt religious organizations in the future from federal and local and state restrictions on discrimination on the basis of sexual preference?
There's things they can do. Yes, they can. He was going to try to pass a regulation to get around having to go through Congress. That is a possibility. What do you do at that point? Well, I think you deal with the political consequences of that. He would lose a lot of votes next time around. And, for all the thought out there that the Democrats get the gay vote, near a third of the gay voters voted for Bush. If they're going to be excluded from services, I'm not sure how big that vote's going to be, not to mention our friends and family members. And I think it scares moderates as well out there of both parties and independents when you have somebody who is trying to legalize discrimination instead of going the other way and fighting it, and also giving carte blanche to these organizations to spend as much as they want and exclude people using public money. Our country is not founded on that.
I think the timing of the Salvation Army debacle really puts the plan at risk, because before this it was all hypothetical. Are they going to discriminate? Are they going to use it this way? It went from hypothetical to very real and in a vivid way. And I think, when people's rights are being pawned off and dealt like it's a card game, then I think, everyone stops and takes pause and says, we need to tweak this or change it or kill it, because our worst fears are coming true. Our nightmares are coming to fruition. And, I think the Salvation Army debacle really is going to challenge this to get it passed. What they have in mind of religious diversity is really not freedom of religion. They're going to be happy to give it to the Muslim organizations right now, the Jewish organizations, the Christian, obviously, and perhaps even the Buddhist. But that's it. That's anything else I think they're going to fight. And that's not freedom of religion. That's multiple choice religion. It's like, here's four or five, pick one, and you can get funded. But if you believe in anything else, the Wiccans maybe, something like that, Scientology, then we're not going to fund you. So, again, it's multiple choice religion under the guise of freedom of religion. And that's really a step in our country we've never taken before.
That was Wayne Besson, Associate Director of Communications with the Human Rights Campaign. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-628-4160 or visit their website at www.hrc.org. Five members of Pastors for Peace, a project of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, offered a new challenge to the 41-year-old U.S. economic embargo of Cuba on Thursday, July 12th, when they re-entered the United States with more than 30 pounds of bio-rat, a Cuban-made rat poison scientists there claim is an environmentally safe rodenticide. U.S. customs officials maintain that bio-rat is toxic for humans and a hazard to the environment, and the product is now in the hands of the EPA after being confiscated on the Texas border. IFCO Pastors for Peace returned from what was their 12th caravan of unlicensed humanitarian aid that they had organized and delivered to the people of Cuba since it began in 1992. The latest caravan arrived in Cuba on July 4th with 75 tons of aid, including medical supplies, complete contents of three doctor's offices, and over 200 bicycles. Reverend Lucius Walker is founder of Pastors for Peace and spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about how this product could benefit the poor and disenfranchised in the U.S. and his decades-long struggle against the American economic blockade against Cuba.
We returned after having taken 80 tons of aid to Cuba with really symbolic but very seriously intended and significant aid to share with peoples in the United States. We brought back a small amount of solar panels, but a smaller variety that can be used in homes where there are no electricities or communities that are not electrified. More importantly, we brought back a number of kilos of a rodenticide called BioRat, which is a tremendously promising product. That's been used in Cuba for 28 years, and Cuba has exported it commercially to a number of other countries.
Is this an environmentally friendly product?
It is non-pathogenic to human beings or other forms of life. It is environmentally friendly. It will not hurt plants or pets. It is biodegradable, so that it simply avoids many of the problems which poor communities now experience when they use rodenticides that are sold commercially in the United States. So I am so excited because this caravan is opening a new level of discussion. We're moving into a whole new arena within the blockade, reality. We're forcing the nation to consider how we as U.S. citizens can benefit from biotechnology that in Cuba has advanced in this area beyond anything we have in the United States.
What happened to the product when you returned to Mexico?
Well, first, to our surprise, the product was not seized. The customs officials didn't even examine the vehicles. They let us through, although we did everything possible to tell them we have BioRat and we think you might want to examine, because we fully expected the BioRat to be seized. Well, about 50, 60 miles north as we traveled up towards San Antonio, at a checkpoint, a Customs Border Patrol checkpoint, some special agents stopped us and said they had heard from the media that we had BioRat, and they wondered if this was true. We told them yes. They wanted to know if we would voluntarily give it to them to retain until we made an appeal to the EPA. And after 2.5 hours of discussion and negotiation, that's essentially what we did. This means that it's been retained but not seized, so the legal implications are less onerous for us. And the door is still open. The way still exists for us to possibly have the Bio-Rat returned to us if we can encourage the EPA to take a serious look at the voluminous amount of research which has been done on this project, both in Cuba and in other countries.
Customs officials stated that they were citing public safety rather than politics in the seizure.
I think they seem to have bent over backwards to not make this a Cuba issue. They sounded as though they didn't even want to know that the product came from Cuba. I think knowing that on that basis we would really use civil disobedience and not back down, they based their concerns on the matter of public safety, namely that their product had not been cleared by the EPA. We can also have communities around the country, as they learn about the Bio-Rat, write us and ask us for some of the product. And we'll present all this evidence along with our appeal to the EPA of the retention, asking that it be released to us.
One other thing I wanted to mention that does tie into this is the Bush administration's policy. Mm-hmm. That was the Title III clause of the Helms-Burton Act. Do you want to comment on that?
Bush did the only politically safe thing he could do, even if he wanted to see that title, which would allow for lawsuits to be filed in U.S. courts for citizens of other countries, for example, Europeans, who have any interest in properties in Cuba that were at some point in the past owned by Cubans who defected, who fled, who are in the United States. It's such an arrogant, extraterritorial presumption of power that if Bush had not waived that, his current or pending trip to Europe would have been a disaster, because Europeans are up in arms about the United States' presumption to try their citizens in U.S. courts for their property holdings in Cuba. So he did what Clinton did. He waived it, which means it is not in effect now. But that said, everything else that Bush has done related to Cuba sends a very, very troubling signal.
That was Reverend Lucius Walker, founder and director of IFCO Pastors for Peace, based in New York City. For more information, call area code 212-926-5757 or visit their website at www.ifconews.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.